Florida's Black Caucus has some ideas for police reform, but they might face an uphill battle winning Republican support. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Better police training, demilitarizing units, and a police conduct registry are all part of the plan. We'll hear from one of their leaders today about the upcoming session. Also,
he was someone who really was seen as the face of the emergent Democratic Party, was someone being talked about to potentially be a vice presidential pick.
Former gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum had high aspirations, but political loss, alcoholism, and infidelity rocked his life. We'll look at Gillum's story and how bisexuality is seen in politics. And finally, we talk with Sundial Book Club author Karen Russell about the February title, Swamplandia. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. With the Florida legislature set to begin in a couple of weeks, with criminal justice reform being a top priority for many lawmakers, Republicans, spearheaded by Governor Ron DeSantis, are moving forward on a bill that would severely limit local government's ability to reduce police budgets. Furthermore, it cracks down on protest in response to the Black Lives Matter movement that launched en masse last summer. Now, members of Florida's Black Caucus are pushing forward their own legislation, taking a much different approach to criminal justice with a focus on police accountability and demilitarization. Joining us now is Democratic Representative from Broward County, Bobby DuBose. Mr. DuBose, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for having me.
You know, we spoke last week on the program about this House Bill 1, this combating public disorder bill, and it's heading to another subcommittee today or this week. You've raised concerns about language in the legislation, but do you think there's any way this bill could be altered that it would receive bipartisan support?
There's always a possibility for a bill to be altered. There will be several amendments offered up, and it's just a matter of if the Republican leadership is open to that. But to be honest with you, I personally feel everything about this bill is wrong. And to make this bill a more bipartisan bill would just really just not follow this bill. I mean, to be honest, it's unnecessary. It's not needed. And it particularly targets communities of color. And so being a member of that community, I directly feel the impact of any legislation that's being shaped and targeted towards people of color as being bad. So I personally don't feel there's any way to improve this bill in a way that it won't have a negative impact on communities of color.
And as you pointed out, I mean, this is originally created in response to the Black Lives Matter movement last summer, but then you had the attack on the U.S. Capitol in January, and, you know, here we see protests reach dangerous levels. Did your mind change when you saw mostly white Trump supporters attack the U.S. Capitol?
I think that's where the difference is. That was a riot attack, the terms that you used, and where this bill arrived at was primarily peaceful protests that individuals were invoking their rights to, protest their government. And so there's a complete different response here. So I did not see the two as the same. I think what we had in D.C. were domestic terrorists. And I think the distinction that you made in regards to color is very important, because it was predominantly white folks that the insurgents. And, you know, I got to tell you, there were people that lost their lives, and my heart goes out to them. But I firmly believe had that group of individuals been people of color, we would still be dealing with, folks being killed, the number would be definitely a lot higher than what it is.
As I mentioned at the beginning, the state's Black Caucus is pushing forward some proposals on fair and just policing. And before we get into a couple of those, I wanted to ask you, what does that mean? Help us understand what that fair and just policing would look like.
I think fair and just policing looks like policing that's applied to one America, one Florida. Right now, it feels as if we live in two Floridas. So when we talk about policing, there's a different standard, there's a different code, there's a different reaction, and typically a different outcome when you come into communities like mine, communities of color, as opposed to communities that are predominantly white and how they're policed. So for me, fair and just policing is it provides a safer Florida, not only for all communities, but also for police officers. So I think the policies that were proposed by the Black Caucus in support of the Democratic Caucus in the House and the Senate, and even our Progressive Caucus, really speaks to that. And it puts something on the table where we all can feel safe, where we all can feel like we're in one Florida.
You know, and you keep talking about that. You know, it's you say you see two Floridas. Is this a Florida-specific problem?
It's not a Florida-specific problem. It is a nationwide problem. We see a lot of this play out in a lot of different areas of the country, a lot of different positions. But when I say, you know, one Florida, is because the legislation that we shape is for the residents of Florida, but not taken away from the fact that we can be the model. We can set policy. We can achieve fair and just policing in Florida and let that be the standard and the model for the rest of the country, because you are correct. This is a national issue.
Now, one of the things, too, after the Black Lives Matter movement is that there was a lot of talk of defunding police. That became a national conversation as well. And, of course, you saw pushback from the right. And I wanted to clarify this. My understanding reading through this proposal is that this isn't about defunding police at all. You want to avoid that, right?
Right. It was never about defunding the police. That was just a term that became a narrative and that was used and politicized, because if you were to look at the content and the proposal, it's always been about fair and just policing. I wonder if that those were the terms used back then, would they still have taken that political opportunity and used it? It's really unfortunate when things like this happen and we politicize them, because at the end of the day, people are dying because of the lack of effort. People are dying because of these incorrect narratives. So,
and yet, if I may, that, you know, you have criminal justice reform advocates that argue that police are overburdened with services, and so you should take some money and give it to other institutions. So why isn't defunding or reallocation a part of the proposal to help?
Because, you know, coming from local government and understanding that when it comes to any services, be it police, fire, and so forth, that they know those communities intimately. And so they have the budget to put those funds and those resources there. You know, when I was in the city of Fort Lauderdale, you know, we had police officers that were tasked specifically to do certain things that had certain skill sets. So where in one community, the city or the municipality may use funding, and they may partner with a third party group or a third party as relates to mental health or something like that. So I think if you look at it, you gotta keep in the local government's authority to really provide the services to their community, their constituents, because they're closer to them. It's not a one size fit all. And so it's not about defunding. And if that city wants to reallocate funding, that the dollars are still there. They may be moved around. They may be moved around because they don't have adequate, you know, police officers or whatever the case may be. Yeah. But it was never about, you know, just taking money away, because there are officers that are burdened. There are officers that are asked to be, you know, an advocate for people with mental health that don't really have an understanding for any of that. So right. I think the broader conversation is allowing those local governments to service their communities based on their needs.
I'm talking with Bobby DuBose. He's a Democrat in the Florida legislature representing Broward County. Again, the Florida legislature is going to start up the 2021 session in just a couple of weeks. One of the other things I wanted to get to, sir, is one of the proposals is for a police misconduct registry. Briefly explain that.
You know, so too often you have bad cops that really give a bad name to all police officers. And then where one department may decide, hey, we want to get rid of this bad apple. Well, then they're allowed to go out and go to another part of the state or somewhere and, you know, get a job and get hired. And there may not be any knowledge of the reason why they were left. So this particular bill, House Bill 277, that's being presented by Representative Geraldine Thompson, would require FDLE to establish and maintain a statewide police misconduct registry. And it will track the information related to local and state law enforcement officers.
And but do you have support from the unions on that?
And so I haven't heard any, you know, grumblings against. Again, it's, you know, Representative Thompson's bill. I understand what it is, but she's working on it. She's working with the stakeholders. And so as the process and session start, we'll continue to massage these bills. But this is one. And again, I would think that this would help police. It would help their image, would help the unions, because if there are bad actors, they're not able to continue, as we have seen in the past, you know, typically where something really egregious happens in an interaction with a police officer, we later find out that there's all this history and it may have happened when they worked somewhere else.
And you have, you talk about that, you talk about the bad actor. So it's that bad apple theory. And I mean, we talked about that at length on this program, and that's been disproven. There are systemic problems in policing. Do you think a registry is just a Band-Aid on a very big problem?
Well, I think that this is part of the equation. As you stated, there are several pieces to this puzzle, and this is one of them. I don't think this will magically make everything go away, but this would definitely help, and this is definitely a step in the right direction.
Do you have do you have enough Republican support on any of these proposals in this plan?
Well, we'll see. We just rolled it out, and these bills we're asking for them to be heard, and also my colleagues across the aisle have an opportunity to co-sponsor these bills, and hopefully they will. And, you know, to your listeners who understand the importance of this, you know, reach out to, you know, lawmakers across the state, whether they are Republicans or Democrats, and make them understand that it's important and that it's time, it's long overdue, and let Florida take the lead as it relates to fair and just policing. Because, you know, listen, Lewis, at the end of the day, this is a life or death issue. And, you know, as a father of four young black males, you know, I get sick of having the talk, because we live in two Floridas, we live in two Americas, and we just have not corrected laws that have been put on the books a very long time ago when we were in a much different place. And in fact, some of this stuff predates, you know, us having certain rights. So, you know, for me, it's critical. It's life or death. And I'm happy for you to, you know, give this time on your show so that as we start at this process, your listeners can engage and amplify our message and reach out so that we can have that bipartisan support.
There's one more thing I wanted to ask you before I let you go, is because the other big thing, obviously, that we're dealing with, you're talking about life and death, is this pandemic. Just wanted to know your thoughts on what you think the session is going to be doing on the issue of dealing with getting vaccines out. Even though we're waiting for the federal government to get us those vaccines, you know, what more can we be doing as a state? Do you think we're doing enough?
It's never enough when people are dying. You know, a lot of this stuff predates the pandemic. It's just equitable access to healthcare in communities of color. That's why we see in my community people are disproportionately dying and being affected. But I think what we can do this session is one. You know, we'll be doing our budget to make sure that we allocate funding, make sure we look at our healthcare system, you know, and the simple things too, is just to make sure that everyone continues to wear a mask and stay safe and encourage folks to make sure they get the vaccine, you know, a couple of weeks ago, weekend.
The other thing too, real quickly, and I bring it up is because we see that we've known from the beginning that this virus has affected the Black community, you know, much more disproportionately than the white community. And now in getting the vaccine out, we still see that the Black community is not getting serviced, you know, in this case, as fast as the white community.
And that is correct. I think, and in my opinion, I feel that we should have rolled out the vaccines to the hardest hit communities. We saw the spikes there for numerous reasons. But if we were to follow that model, I think we would see a greater response and our numbers would be down even further. There are so many issues that politics plays into this on the front end and even now. But, you know, I will say this, there has been an effort by the state to target Black communities through the Black churches and put in these pods. I had 2 weeks ago in my district, we had over 1,200 people that received the vaccine. And yeah, we just need to increase that number. We need to keep targeting and understanding that folks' lives are at risk.
I have to stop you there because of time, but something we're going to keep following, obviously, again, as the session begins in just a couple of weeks. Bobby DuBose, Democrat in Florida, the Florida legislature representing Broward County. Mr. DuBose, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, Andrew Gillum was considered to be the next star of the Democratic Party. What caused his dramatic fall, and what is next for his future? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. 3 years ago, former Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum was a rising star in the Democratic Party. He'd surprised many by winning the gubernatorial nomination and was only 30,000 votes shy of becoming the first Black leader of the Sunshine State. After Gillum lost, his life went into a downward spiral. Last March, he was launched into the national spotlight following an arrest on Miami Beach. A leaked police report included photos of him with drugs and naked men. Gillum has since gone through alcohol rehab and is working to repair his marriage. In this month's GQ, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Wesley Lowery spoke with Gillum and his wife, RJ, about politics, bisexuality, and public redemption. It's part of their Modern Lovers issue, focusing on high-profile relationships that explore the many varieties of love in the 21st century. And we spoke with Wesley last week.
Well, look, I think that as a general rule, right, I think a lot of people are interested. I think Andrew Gillum is unquestionably interesting. He's interesting for a lot of reasons. One, he was someone who really was seen as the face of the emergent Democratic Party, very well regarded across the party, resistance darling during the Trump years, one of the kind of leading surrogates prior to kind of the public embarrassment, was someone being talked about to potentially be a vice presidential pick, or even, you know, there were some people who were asking him if he might even run for president himself in this last cycle. And so he was someone who, absent what ended up happening last year, was still going to be a major player in our politics. And because of that, is someone who could someday again become a major player in our politics.
So your story really focuses on that relationship between Gillum and his wife, RJ. And when did Gillum's bisexuality become a part of the conversation? When did he talk about it with her?
So what they told me is that, you know, Andrew had always, but since childhood known he was bisexual, even if he didn't always have the words or completely understand it. It was something he was kind of aware of early on. And So once they got more serious, you know, they kind of dated on and off. And look, we've all been in our early 20s and know how that might be or what that might look like, right? They dated on and off for a while. But when they actually got back together for good and were kind of more serious talking about things like marriage and whatnot, he told me that he kind of confided in her, wanted her to know, you know, he dated some men in the past and this was something that was just part of him. And so they had one of those conversations, you know, while they were seriously dating, but before they were engaged, before they were married.
And, you know, bringing up the issue of bisexuality, I mean, because he mentioned it in the story, it's the challenge that he faced growing up is, again, how black families and the black community view bisexuality. And we shouldn't generalize, but how would you say black male sexuality is seen in a lot of these households? What did he tell you?
Well, so what I would actually note is that I think there's a 2-for-1 here, right? Because I think before we can even talk about things with the black community, we have to understand how bisexuality is viewed in general across the board, right? It's not that black communities or black people have any particular aversion. It's that culturally across the country, there's still a lot of confusion about kind of what bisexuality is and how it operates, you know, what it is. That very often, kind of stereotypically, women who are bisexual are written off as, oh, you're going through a phase, or you just like making out with your girlfriends, but you're really gonna end up with a man. And in many cases, there's an assumption that men who identify as bisexual are in fact secretly gay, but they feel societal pressures to, you know, put on the airs of masculinity. And so that's certainly true in church-going conservative parts of the country, no matter the race or gender, ethnicity, and that's especially true across the South. Now, what we know about the Black South is that it tends to be a little more conservative than the urban South or the urban Black communities of the North. And so Andrew growing up and RJ growing up as well, both of them kind of grew up in Southern Black church-going, more conservative-leaning families, would have been growing up in these same types of environments that, again, are similar all over the place. Beyond that, though, you then have kind of the media representation of that, the extent to which Black bisexuality, especially among men, is ever portrayed in popular culture, is almost always discussed through this concept of the quote-unquote down low, about, you know, Black gay men who have wives but are secretly hooking up with each other. And so there's a ton of stigma around that. And so, and again, that stigma, I think, becomes self-reinforcing when these relationships are things that are, or these people's sexualities are things that are framed in popular culture, in public conversation, as things that are in some way deviant, secretive, right? You're married to a woman, but you're secretly doing this other stuff. That doesn't make you very likely to then open up and discuss it openly, right? Yeah. And what you're, and so you see how that kind of reinforces. And so, you know, Gillum came up at a time that's very different than, say, if you were an adolescent today. And I think that that combined with the fact that he was very quickly a public figure. He was someone who was in elected office essentially his entire adulthood. And so it was some of these things about how he showed up in public were decisions he was making pretty young. And once they were made, to change your mind would be to undo it. And to have to then face the potential stigma of, well, why did you hide this from us for so long?
Yeah. Just to note, too, I mean, he was born in Miami-Dade, raised in Gainesville. So you speak about that, you know, growing up in the South. The other thing I wanted to ask you, he mentioned it in the story, was at one point they considered whether or not he should come out. And what was behind that decision not to?
Yeah, so he was talking about, so this would be before his 2014 run for mayor. And so this is really when he's breaking out kind of in the national scene in a way that's different, becoming more well-known. And you have to remember at the time, this is before the Obergefell decision, and so marriage equality was still a major issue for debate across the country in a lot of ways. We didn't have legalized gay marriage across the country. And so he told me that one of the things he thought might be useful in that debate was to be able to talk about it personally, all right? To be able to, you know, to be able, it might make him a stronger advocate. And so they floated the idea of, look, this is real, more major public office, not just a city commissioner, but this is going to be the mayoral run that then might lead to the governor run or the Senate run, right? And so maybe this is the juncture to do it. But at the time, he had advisors who basically said, don't do it. It's too messy. It'll raise too many questions. And also in his relationship with his wife, there was this thought of, even as a public figure, how much of our personal lives is the public owed, right? Might this raise questions about our marriage, that we don't want to be dealing with in public. And so at the time, the decision was, even as Andrew kind of perhaps wanted to do it a little bit or said he did, it raised this question of not of whether or not they would get blowback about their marriage, and his, how he has to balance being both a public figure as well as his familial obligations.
I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize winning GQ reporter Wesley Lowry. His latest story explores Andrew Gillum's fall from a top leader in Florida's Democratic Party to an infamous evening in Miami Beach. You can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. As you mentioned, and we've noted right. many times, I mean, he had been in politics most of his adult life, and you know, he was a very young Tallahassee city councilman. But what was it? Is there one thing, one moment that, you know, we can point to and say that's what launched him into the national conversation, and how he became the gubernatorial candidate, and all of a sudden he was being discussed as a possible VP candidate? How did he go from just that city council guy to all of a sudden he's possibly one of the stars of the Democratic Party?
You know, I'm not sure that there was necessarily one moment, although he was weighing in on a lot of things he did. I mean, on marriage equality, I think he very prominently said as mayor, he would, you know, if other places wouldn't marry gays and lesbians, that he would marry them on city hall steps, right? That he was very much involving himself in big national conversations, positioning himself as a leader in the party. He was a pretty prominent surrogate on behalf of the Clinton campaign, and had been, and was one of their kind of leading black surrogates, ends up in the Obama orbit a bit. And so it was just kind of widely regarded in, certainly in Washington, D.C. circles, in black political circles, that he was kind of an up-and-comer. And then you get to the Trump administration, where you have a very mobilized Democratic Party and left wing of the country. This was one of him and Stacey Abrams come up in these big races that happened not long after the Trump election, where there's a lot of grassroots energy on the left to try to show some resistance to the Trump administration. And Andrew, like I said, along with Stacey Abrams and John Ossoff in his congressional race, and Beto O'Rourke in his Senate race, become in a lot of ways the faces of the emerging Democratic Party in response to Donald Trump. And so Andrew really was one of those people throughout that process.
So he lost to Republican Ron DeSantis by 32,000 votes. Very close race. Turns out it was emotionally devastating for him. What happened after that race was over? Because that's when we didn't notice, a lot of people didn't notice, he started sliding down.
Yeah. So he talks about, and him and RJ talk about to me, that, you know, the governor's race, in fact, was really difficult on them, the race itself. But he's all around the state. She's at home with the kids. They're not spending much time together. There's a lot of distance. He loses the race. And for the first time in adulthood, he's not on a government payroll. He's not an elected official or running for office. He starts drinking more heavily, and he's got some alcoholism that runs in his family. But he talks about kind of just this depression, right? He was gliding on top of the earth. And there was a world where people were openly speculating, and certainly speculating in Democratic circles. Well, he gets elected governor of Florida, the next thing's a White House run. You know, so to go from that to being just a guy is something you imagine would be kind of shattering. And so he kind of slowly begins having this breakdown at the same time that there's a real schism in their marriage.
So it was March 13th of last year when the nation saw him basically hit rock bottom. And we remember that's the beginning of the lockdowns of the coronavirus in the U.S. But what happened that he actually was making the headlines when the pandemic started?
Yeah, you know, in March, there's a report, one, I think it's a Friday morning or Saturday morning, from Candace Owens, a conservative, I mean, pretty far right commentator, where someone has leaked to her a police report from an incident the night before. And in that police report, it says Andrew Gillum was in a hotel room, found kind of incapacitated and naked, or at least out of it and naked, that there was another person there who the internet quickly figured out was a gay sex worker, and that he had overdosed seemingly on drugs. And so there was a third man potentially in the room. And so suddenly it quickly starts spinning. Like, what was, like, so the former gubernatorial candidate was involved in some type of drug overdose with a bunch of men, and no one's wearing clothes, and there are drugs in the room. What's going on? Not long after that, some of these pictures start to publish. The police accidentally release the crime scene photos, or say they accidentally release the crime scene photos to the Daily Mail, which shows this disheveled room and pills on the floor and all of these other things. And then additional photos showing Gillum himself passed out and unclothed start showing up on right-wing blogs. And so quickly there's this kind of public narrative that he had been involved in some type of gay sex orgy or something, you know, and like no one quite knew what was happening. Gillum withdraws from public life, and he now, you know, announces he's going to alcoholism rehab, but says essentially, look, I wasn't doing any drugs. I met up with a friend. We all got too drunk, or, you know, and I don't know what happened.
Yeah. There are two stories about that night from your research. One is from Gillum and the other is from Travis Dyson, the male sex worker Gillum was with in that hotel. How different are those stories?
They're pretty different, right? So Andrew's story he told me, he told Tamron Hall in an interview, is essentially that, look, this is someone I knew, I met up, I was handed a drink. The next thing I knew, I was naked and it was 5 hours later. That there was some type of setup, that perhaps he was drugged, right? What Travis Dyson, the sex worker from the room, told me, and he was the first time he had spoken publicly on this at any length, was that he him and Andrew had met on the gay dating app Grindr, they'd met and hooked up a few times prior, and that those interactions had involved kind of consensual drug use, and that in this case it was just Andrew kind of accidentally overdosed. And so those are kind of the warring stories here, where Andrew publicly is talking about or is laying out a narrative in which he kind of didn't know what was happening or where this was, you know, or what might have happened that night. And Travis essentially saying, well, he knew what was going on. And it just, you know, everything went a little too far. He accidentally overdosed. And then, you know, the public found out.
There is this fascination in this country with seeing the rise and then the subsequent fall of public figures. And we've seen a lot of instances recently with like Britney Spears and the Lance Armstrong documentaries. We love to see stars emerge from the ashes. Is there hope in the Gillum story? Does he have hope that there's redemption and that he might be back in the public again at some point?
Look, I think there could be. You know, you never know. As you know, we're having a ton of conversation about this now. Britney Spears, Lance Armstrong, Tiger Woods documentary just came out. I think first and foremost, there's a question of whether it's something he wants, right? If he decides to pursue public life again, which to me doesn't sound like a settled question, or even if it would be completely up to him, you know, still in a marriage, and it's clear the family was embarrassed by all of this and harmed by all of this in some ways. But I also think secondarily, there is this question of who are we as a people, right? That these are, you know, you've got so many different components to this. You've got the idea that there were drugs there. You have the potential cultural taboos about bisexuality or gay sex. You have the idea that perhaps he wasn't completely forthcoming about it, right? And then there's the question of would the public be willing to set aside or forgive any of those individual things, much less all of them together? So I don't know. You know, I do think that we're a very different public than we were in the 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s. And who knows where we might be 5 years from now or 10 years from now, that politicians routinely get forgiven, or at the very least, people choose to forget all types of things. And I don't think that Andrew Gillum necessarily would be exempt from that. But I do wonder, you know, this is different. We have not dealt with many scandals that deal with sexuality in this way.
You can read this full in-depth piece on Gillum and explore G. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, growing up in South Florida, Karen Russell took regular trips with her family into the swampy regions of the state to some very unique places. And she beautifully brings that world to us in her book, Swamplandia. It's the story of a family pretending to be Native American and operating a gator theme park in the middle of the Everglades. but the family faces numerous losses, and each member is forced to head out on their own to make sense of the tragedies and what may come next. We spoke with author Karen Russell yesterday about what inspired this novel, and she took some of your questions. In the time that you grew up here, how much gator wrestling did you actually get to see as a kid?
Yeah, I went to the Miccosukee Reservation on a field trip. We would go like every year in elementary school, and it left such an impression on me. And I think also, you know, we went to the Everglades frequently when I was a kid. It was like my favorite place, and it was also, you know, sort of terrifying to me in a wonderful way, in this like sublime way. We would go bike riding on Shark River Valley, you know, so nobody was like wrestling those alligators. But I do remember the kind of exhilaration of knowing you were prey potentially, you know, just sort of, it was a great motivation to kind of like keep up with the other people on the bikes, because you didn't want to like fall too far behind in this landscape full of buzzards and alligators. And yeah, that was, so I think that must've imprinted on me strongly, is seeing, you know, these men on the backs of these, you know, Mesozoic creatures. And I didn't totally understand probably, you know, the anatomy of the gator's jaw that like, you know, enables this sort of display, you know, like if you can get an alligator's jaw shut, the muscles that open the jaw are very weak, actually. So you're in a good position. Mm. But, you know, it's a tricky part is, you know, like I wouldn't say, there was a moment where I had researched this book and I was like, yeah, if a gator waddled into my house, I would know just what to do. And now I've like forgotten a lot of that life-saving knowledge. So I'm lucky to live in Oregon.
My understanding, yeah, the story of Ava and her sister, that was part of an earlier story, right? That was part of your earlier works, the St. Lucie's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves?
This novel started, the kernel of the novel was a short story, like a 12-page short story about these two weird sisters in sort of a mythic version of the Everglades on this very like isolated island theme park. And their mother had just died, and they were dealing with this loss in different ways. And the older sister, who was like a teenager and, you know, whatever, like a horny teenager, but there are not many eligible bachelors on a swamp island. So she was sort of dating the dead, using the Ouija board as like her Rolodex, and also, you know, using the Ouija board as a means to try and communicate with their mother, who had, you know, sort of vanished. And then the little sister was like watching her teenage sister, you know, leaving the land, you know, sort of becoming this young woman. And I think like we forget as adults how terrifying that transition is to undergo. And also, you know, if you're the younger sibling, you know, how frightening it is to feel like maybe you're losing a connection with a sibling who's growing up, you know, who's doing all of these things before you. So that was the story. And I really had this idea that because I knew these characters well, and I sort of felt like I knew that landscape, it would be easy to write a novel about them. And that was not the case, Luis.
So here you have Ava and her family, and they sell themselves off as this Native American family running this theme park in the Everglades, Swamplandia. But they're not really Native American.
No.
They're pretending.
No. And I think the kids, I mean, it sort of scales with their ages. So there's this young brother. He's not young, right? He's like a teenager also. He's sort of like, Dad, this is so messed up. This is wrong, what we're doing. The dad has been, yeah, selling, you know, there's sort of, I think what he's going for is the same kind of for-profit fantasy you see in a lot of like the B-side roadside attractions in Florida, you know? And it's a complete papering over, you know, of like the real horror story of how, you know, the collision of kind of early settlers and the indigenous people of Florida. And also, you know, sort of the Indian Wars, which lasted longer than the Vietnam War, which I, you know, had no idea about when I started writing this book. So sort of some of the process of growing up for these kids is coming to understand that what they're doing is indefensible, you know. And they have, they're able to understand that kind of in different ways, contingent on their age. You know, I think the littlest kid really wants this fiction to be true. She really wants to have a tradition and a home. She wants deep roots in this landscape that she loves. And so maybe she's less willing to kind of, or able to understand what's happening to her. And she's sort of, I think, dealing with a lot of loss and doing that kid arithmetic where you sort of, she's at that age where she can almost like move seamlessly between registers and have kind of dip her toe into an adult understanding of what's happening. And then she retreats into like this kid fantasy world, you know. But anyway, yeah, yes, that's what they call themselves, the Big Trees. And in fact, you know, alligator wrestling, which was a spectacle to draw tourists to Florida, it is a stolen tradition. You know, the Seminole and Miccosukee people wrestled alligators for food and for their hides, you know, and it was also, you know, there was a performative, there was a ritual aspect too. And sort of white settlers to Florida saw this and they saw an opportunity.
I wondered when you were writing it, because I mean, you go back almost a decade now, and how sensitivities have changed in the world. And
yes,
do you
yeah.
think that you could do that, that you could write a story about a family pretending to be Native American when, you know, you see the sensitivity today and everybody's like about authenticity and wanting to be careful not to insult anybody?
Yes. Well, you know, that's a really interesting question. And I have thought many times, I wrote this novel between the ages of like, you know, the story when I was 22 and then this book, you know, between the ages of like 25 and 28, probably. Right. So I feel like a very different woman at 40 and the world has changed so much in a wonderful way. I think like we have all, many of us are, we have like a new awareness and a new sensitivity, as you say. And one of the things I wish that my younger self, like if I was approaching this, I think I would approach that aspect of the story very differently. Definitely my ambition in Swamplandia was to shine a light on that exact, you know, the for-profit fantasy and sort of like, you know, the spectacle versus sort of the real bloody, frightening kind of history. And a lot of that in Florida, you know, it's we live on artificial bedrock. You know, Disneyland itself is like on the drain swamp. I think there's all these ways that you see that dynamic in Florida of sort of like a kind of amnesia, you know, a kind of willful amnesia that lets us exploit the land and, you know, and lets us also, you know, exploit other people.
We're talking with author Karen Russell, who wrote Swamplandia. It is the February title for the Sundial Book Club. It's the story of a family pretending to be Native American running a theme park in the Everglades. There is tragedy, but there's also a lot of hope in the story. Now, if you want, you can join the Sundial Book Club. Just find us on Facebook. Just look up Sundial Book Club. It's free. We'd love to have you. Tell us what you think of the book. Also, tell us about some of the other works that you're reading right now. Really, my favorite character, the mother. I wanted to ask you about Halola Big Tree, the star attraction of Swamplandia. You get connected to her. But spoiler alert, she dies early. She dies of cancer. And for me, the story is about loss. It's this, the loss of Swamplandia, but the loss of the mother and how everybody's handling loss. But I'm wondering, how did you think about how you wanted to write the way the children especially dealt with the loss of their mother and the kind of darkness they fall into?
Yeah, you know, I think that it's sort of a funny way to begin a novel. And for a long time, the beginning sort of eluded me, and I got a very good suggestion from a friend who said, we don't really know the before, you know, we know the after. We're meeting this family in the aftermath of this like terrible loss, but what was like an Eden bubble for this child? What's the memory that sort of holds the paradise of childhood for her? And then, you know, I sent her this picture of my own mother who was in the FSU circus with her brother. That also really imprinted on me as a kid, just like these images of my mom and my uncle. They were the Rolla Romanchuks, and they had like this acrobat show that they did. Mm. And then they like went on, you know, my mom went to law school. You know, she was like the first person in her family to like, she put herself through college, and she's like this, you know, you would not see her today and necessarily think, oh yeah, she was wearing a bathing suit on the shoulders of her brother, like doing a tumbling act. But she just in these pictures, she is like, to me as a kid too, you think your mother's like the most beautiful person in the universe, you know? And it was like sort of this eavesdropping on the world before my birth, you know? I do think like there's an elegy inside this book, and some of it is for the world of my parents, like the Florida that I just missed knowing, when the sky was teeming with birds, when the sea was teeming with fish, you know, there was so much degradation that happened to coincide with my lifetime, you know, like the acceleration of like these Anthropocene disasters, you know. And so I was sort of kind of becoming aware at exactly the moment that this like rise in ecological consciousness was happening, and, you know, watching the skyline of Miami, you know, the urban boundary lines getting pushed farther and farther, all these skyscrapers going up, so much development. There was, I think it's loss in a lot of senses, right? It's like there's loss inside this family for sure. And then there's also this sensation of like the vertiginous, like Alice in Wonderland, down the rabbit hole kind of vertigo of losing your home in a larger sense, or losing some way of living with nature.
I think about Ava, and I don't know if it seems like to me, maybe the more sane of the characters, or maybe it's just the way she's handling the loss of her mother. She wants to step right into her shoes and become the main attraction. But I wondered, you know, mostly with Ava, how much of the kids are you? How much of Ava's you? Oh.
Well, I have a brother and a sister, and I feel so close to them both. And they would both beg me to tell you now that these are just, you know, this is my own psyche refracted. I think they were very keen for me to say, like, please, like, my brother was like, what, the brother's gonna be like a fire crotch virgin? I was like, sorry, Kent, you know. And then my sister was like, sister, please stop writing about sisters, love your sister, you know. So I mean, I think, you know, I do feel incredibly close with my family, and so you're always extrapolating a little bit from, I mean, what else do you have to build out of, you know? It's your own memories and experience of this life. But I feel close. I do feel like they're all like a little bit of different versions of, you know, I definitely, Kiwi, who's like this sort of poor thing, like working in this, you know, world of darkness, some kind of corporate Disney, you know, the hell that we all know of just like embarrassing, you know, degrading minimum wage employment. Mm-hmm. Like I relate to him in his sort of like, they all, you know, and Aussie is truly like the lost child in this arrangement. And I was telling a friend, like, if you wanted to, you could almost transpose it into like a realist vernacular, and it would just be like set in Jersey, and there'd be like, you know, a daughter who's promiscuous and using drugs, and there'd be, you know, a son who, you know, takes it upon himself to try to like financially save the family. Like, I think that I hope there's some emotional truth that people could connect with, as odd as some parts of this book are. But yeah, Ava, I love that character. Even when she frustrated me, I really love her. And I remember so well, like, kids have that beautiful egotism, you know, where, I mean, I see it in my own kids. My son now, who's 4, he wants to be a superhero. He really wants to save the planet, you know. He, like, he hears about climate change, or, you know, it's such a beautiful impulse. And the flip side of that is he also feels responsible for everything, you know. It's like Atlas shrugged, like, take a load off, son, you're but everything, you know. He if one of us is sad, you know, he clearly thinks he's the cause of that sadness sometimes.
We got 3 questions from our listeners, and I wanted to be able to get these in. Really thoughtful questions. So let's go through these. This first one is from Shirley Smith Bergman. She asks, I was unsettled and creeped out by the relationship between Ava and the Birdman. Now, I realize she was a naive 13-year-old starving for love and attention. Did you write the Birdman as a malevolent character, or as a quirky backwoodsman who took advantage of the situation?
Oh, that's a great question. That's, you know, I'll be really frank with you. That's like the story inside this story, you know, the hell inside this story. That's almost like the most difficult for me to talk about. And it's also, you know, some of the earliest material in this book. Interestingly, before I had any idea, really, you know, he wasn't in the original draft much. It was the sisters. And the story, Ava Russell's The Alligator, the Birdman showed up there and he really scared me. And I hadn't intended actually to write about, you know, childhood sexual abuse. It surprised me when this person came pulling into this story. I think I don't understand people who take advantage of children that way. So it's hard for me to answer that question. You know what I mean? Like, I don't really, his psychology is the most opaque to me of any character in the book. He's the least intelligible. Yeah, I feel like I understand the alligators better than that character.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a fascinating part of the story, and a difficult one. So moving to the next one. This one is from Susan Edgar Lee. She asks, the swamp is writing her own suicide note, a botanist flying over the invasive Melaleuca stands. Can you tell us a little bit about your own experience with the Florida swamp that inspired you to write about this lush but feral world?
These questions are beautiful. Your listeners are poets. It is a lush and feral world, isn't it? I really have this fantasy of myself as this, like, as somebody like Ava, you know, I would like squeal baiting a hook. Like, I wasn't as, as much of a badass as she is. But I did, my dad, and grandfather, you know, he grew up in Sarasota and then he, you know, moved to Miami, and my grandfather on my mom's side, grew up in, he lived in Miami Springs, and they all were just like huge outdoors people. My uncle too. So we kayaked the Colusa Blue Way and we camped out. And, you know, we went to Chokoloskee and we would, you know, launch and camp out on some of those little tree islands. I didn't do the chickies. I always wanted to. I hope I can someday, you know, where you sleep overnight on a chickie in the water and you kind of can hear the gators underneath you and all the fish jumping around you. We camped out on Watson's Island, that haunted island, you know, where like Watson, instead of killing his employees, was just like, you're fired, and killed them. just terrifying. And we went to the Everglades just really frequently. We would like go to the Everglades and then drive back to Miami and eat at Fuddruckers. This was like a ritual. I don't know. I don't know. I'm the only child who associates like Fuddruckers pickles with like a blue heron. it's all the Mobius Strip of Florida, you know.
And that was Karen Russell, author of Swamplandia, the February title for the Sundial Book Club. Join us there. Tell us what you think of the book. Next week, we'll announce the March title. Well, that's our program for today. Coming up tomorrow, the future of recycling. And we'll meet the Jewish Oprah of Boca Raton. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Luis Hernandez. Stay safe. Be good to each other. We'll talk to you live tomorrow.